Have you ever bought something that's fake? Ever bought a fake? Yes. Have you ever gone and paid for something and got some money back and it's like a fake 100 rand? Has that ever happened to you? If you've been to Mozambique and you've exchanged money, you know what fake money looks like. Those guys at the border, you've got to check every banknote. There's this picture of a fake external hard drive. You go to like a flea market and you buy this 2.5 terabyte hard drive and it plug it into home and it's like 4 gig, you know? And then you open it up and it's just like a glue gun has stuck in a flash drive with some nails and they've wired in the light so it looks like it works and it feels heavy, but it actually it isn't the real thing. And you've been deceived by something. Or you take your banknote and you go to the bank and you think you've got this much money and the bank says, you don't have 100 rand, you just have a piece of paper that looks like 100 rand. And there's something about a fake that it does something to us. You see, whenever there's something of value, there's a forgery of that thing. So banknotes get forged because they're valuable, they have a value. All your top brands, you'll find a Louis Vuitton and an 8 West, you know, you will find them. They're there because the original has a value, and so there's a fake. And so you ask yourself, why do people buy fake? Like sometimes you look at something and you're like, that is fake. That is not real. You have not bought the real thing. It's because sometimes they're not prepared to pay the price for the real thing. They just go for the 8 West. They get the, it's a 9 West is a handbag brand. Am I right? Yeah, I was right. Sorry, I don't buy many handbags. It's a good illustration, yeah, it's great. And fakes have these qualities. Some people buy them because they don't want to pay the price. Other people are genuinely deceived, and the fake lets you believe that it's real. You think that's a real note until you get to the bank, and then you realize you actually got nothing. It does something else. It devalues the thing that is real. So if you have a currency and there's lots of fake currency in circulation, the actual currency starts to devalue. It's the same with a brand. If the market is flooded with fakes of that brand, the original brand actually devalues. And that's what fakes do. And wherever there's something of value, there's a fake, and there is a gospel, and it is of incredible value. And there is a fake. You see, when I look at young people, I look at my generation, and the fake I see the most is that we want the kingdom, but we don't want the king. We see something, we recognize something is real, and we want that, but as soon as the king comes close, we're like, okay, I just wanted that. I didn't want all this other nonsense. Just that. Give me the one, leave the rest. And it comes out in examples like this. Maybe you want a good marriage, and you've seen some people, and they've got a good marriage, and you're like, Jesus is in that marriage. There's something happening. I want that. And then God starts to teach you what it means to covenant. And you're like, I don't know about that. We want the marriage, but we don't want to learn about covenant. Or maybe it comes out like this. You've seen people full of life. You've seen that there's life where God is. And you want that, but you are not prepared to recognize the giver of life in your life. Maybe you've seen people with a hope and a joy, and you don't have that, and you want to know where it is, but you do not recognize the one who gives the Spirit, who brings those fruits in other people. See, Paul explains something of this in Galatians. He's talking to the church in Galatia, and they're having this issue with circumcision, and for us, that's kind of weird. Like, who would choose to be circumcised as an adult? It's like, no, I'm okay. It's all fine. Don't touch it. But they're having this big issue, and we don't recognize. We're like, we don't understand what's happening. But it's this thing of if you are a person of God, you should show the sign of God, and that's what the Jews believed. And so it was being put onto the church. And so if you are saved, you should also be circumcised. Just a little bit more you need, and then you are a proper Christian. And he writes this then, he says, I am astonished that you are so quickly deserting the one who called you to live in the grace of Christ and are turning to a different gospel. says, you want the outside sign. And he goes on to explain, rather look for the inside sign. Look for the sign on the inside. And once you have that, the outside sign, it will either come by itself, well, not circumcision, it doesn't happen by itself. But the outward sign that we look for, either it happens by itself or it doesn't matter. So we want the kingdom of God, but we don't want the kingdom. And this is how, this is a story of how I kind of came across this thing where we kind of want God, but we don't really want like all of it. We just want like some. We almost want a line. I was a student once upon a time, and back when Tux was just an open field and a bunch of hooligans running around barefoot. Some of the engineers still do, apparently. And we were meeting, this church was smaller, there were probably about 20 students in this church, and we were meeting on the Ola grass. We'd just pray and hang out, talk nonsense, and then go back to class. And every now and then we would pray and then go and do evangelism, which is not the best way, like one-on-one sort of street evangelism, but it puts something in you. And so one day we were sitting there, and Emmanuel, who's here, I think he's on sound tonight, he comes up and he's about to sit down. He says, hey, there's an imam, a Muslim guy, and he's holding a lecture for all the Muslims on campus and anyone else who's interested. So we're all like, good, let's go. So we all got up and we went and we sat in this. And one day I'll tell what happened there. But afterwards, we are just talking one-on-one sort of with a bunch of fellow Muslim students. Not we Muslim, but they're students. And the one handed me a tract. I don't know if you know what a tract is. It's like a little book that they write. It's a Christian thing where they're like, this is the gospel, and people would use it to help evangelize. And in there were a whole bunch of DVDs of talks given by Muslim guys, one of which obviously being Cat Stevens, because he's like the A-grade example of converting to Islam. And later that week, I was going through it by myself, just watching some of these things. And I found in me, as I was watching this, a strange thing. I knew Jesus. I knew the gospel. But there was something in there that was attractive. There was something in Islam. I was like, that is, these actually make a bit of sense. And what I've learned is that when you get to that sort of thing, where you're like, God, what is happening here? Why this? The best person to ask is God. He can answer questions like that. And so I prayed, and I felt like God saying, what you are attracted to is Christianity without Jesus. What I was so attracted to about this was they're just five pillars, and you do these five things, and you do that a few times a day, and you do that, and then you live in peace. I was like, that sounds good. Because Jesus has this habit of asking me some awkward questions. And if I can just limit the range of questions that he can ask me, then I can live in peace. And so we want something to mediate between us and God. And Jesus, any fake gospel is anything that replaces or adds to Jesus as our access to the Father. And so we have this fake gospel where we want the outcome, but we don't necessarily want the king. And Exodus is a... Last Sunday, Jeff preached about the Israelites going through the Red Sea. And the Sunday before that, Stephen preached... It was Stephen, I think. Maybe it was the morning. Stephen preached about the blood. So here are these Israelites who, if you read carefully, act nothing like God's people. They act exactly like Egyptians. In fact, later on in Exodus 33, God says to them, you are a stiff-necked people. Take off your ornaments so that I can deal with you. A very Egyptian thing was to wear lots of jewelry, lots of ornaments. We've gotten to Exodus 33, and they're still dressing and acting like Egyptians. But we are sitting here in Exodus 15. So we know that when God calls the people out of Egypt, he's not calling people because they are so good. He's calling people because there was blood on their doorpost. Because they went through the Red Sea. See, that blood, Stephen shared it so well, it didn't matter who you were. You could be the most important. You could be the least important. If that blood was not on your door, the angel of death visited your house. Didn't matter. And it didn't matter who you were. If you did not cross the Red Sea, if you were not baptized, it's a picture of baptism into Christ. If you did not cross, You were on the side where the Egyptians came through. And in baptism to Christ, we are baptized, and the whole power of Egypt, the entire Egyptian army, goes in after us, and in Jesus, they are destroyed. All the power that our past has is destroyed. So what I want to share tonight is not about trying to escape Egypt. Egypt is done. It is finished. God never threatens us with Egypt again. What we are talking about is we have a future, and sometimes we don't understand what's happening right now. God has made a promise to his people to take them into a land that he will give them, but right now it looks like they're going to die of thirst. And then it's hunger, and then it's this, and then it's that. And how do they make sense of this? And we can sit in a similar situation where we know what God says. We know about the blood, don't we? We've been baptized. We're in this. And then suddenly it's like, what is this? What is this that's happening? This is not the same God. Where is God now? So I want to read from Exodus 15. But first, from 1 Corinthians, Paul says these things, talking about Exodus, these things happened to them, the Israelites, as an example, and they were written as a warning for us on whom the culmination of ages has come. This story, this Exodus story, is a story for us, examples for us. And so when we read this story, it is a story that happened to the Israelites, but we can draw a lot of meaning out of it. So from chapter 15 and 22. Hey, no, sorry. Exodus 15. Moses led Israel from the Red Sea to the wilderness of Shur. They traveled for 3 days through the wilderness without finding any water. They got to Marah, but they could not drink the water at Marah. It was bitter. That's why they called the place Marah. And the people complained to Moses. So what are we supposed to drink? Moses cried out in prayer to God. God pointed him to a stick of wood. Moses threw it in the water, and the water turned sweet. In chapter 16. So that's the first one. They get to a place, they're thirsty, there's no water, the water's bitter, and God says, throw a stick in, and it becomes sweet. I don't know if you can make any sense of that. Second one. On the 15th day of the second month, after they had left Egypt, the whole company of Israel moved out of Elim to the wilderness of Sin, which was between Elim and Sinai, and the whole company of Israel complained against Moses and Aaron there in the wilderness. And the Israelites said, why didn't God let us die in comfort in Egypt, where we had lamb stew and all the bread we could eat? You've brought us out into this wilderness to starve us to death, the whole company of Israel. And God said to Moses, this is 16 verse 1, sorry. Just if I say a verse, just ignore it. God said to Moses, I'm going to rain bread down on the sky for you. The people will go out and gather each day's rations. I'm going to test them to see if they will live according to my teaching or not. On the sixth day, they will prepare what they have gathered. They will turn out to be twice as much as their daily ration, because on the seventh day, they're supposed to rest. Then jumping to verse 9, Moses instructed Aaron, tell the whole company of Israel, come near to God. He's heard your complaints. Come near to God. He's heard your complaints. Then Aaron gave out the instruction to the whole assembly of Israel, and they turned to the wilderness, and there it was, the glory of God visible in the cloud. God spoke to Moses, I've listened to your complaints, to the complaints of the Israel. Now tell them, at dusk you will eat meat, and at dawn you will eat your fill of bread, and you will realize that I am God. Your God. Then we have the third story. God directed the whole assembly. Do you notice how each of these stories, God directs the assembly in their walk? Sometimes we think when things get difficult, it's because we've missed God somewhere. God directs the assembly, and it's not always easy. That's the whole point on its own. Directed by God, the whole company of Israel moved on by stages from the wilderness of Sin, and they camped at Rehidin. And there wasn't a drop of water for the people to drink. The people took Moses to task. What that actually means is they actually wanted to kill him. They were starting like a court case against him, and they were going to get people and prove him wrong and stone him. So for Moses, it's quite a serious thing. They took Moses to task. give us water to drink. But he said, why pester me? You are testing God. But the people were thirsty for water there. They complained to Moses, why did you take us from Egypt and drag us out here with our children and animals to die of thirst? And Moses cried out to God, what can I do with this people? Any minute now, they will kill me. God says to Moses, go out ahead of the people, taking with you some of the elders and the staff that you used to strike the Nile. And go, and I'm going to present before you there on the rock at Horeb, and you will strike the rock. Water will gush out of it, and the people will drink. God said to Moses, I went back too loud. Moses did what he said, and the elders of Israel, right there watching, he named that place Massa. Hey, biblical names are tough. It means testing place and quarreling, because the quarreling of the Israelites and because of the testing of the Lord God when they said, is God with us or not? You see, to want the kingdom without a king is to want a fake. And the problem with having that fake is we don't always recognize that it's in us. You see, that fake gospel, it's normally a gospel based on the good things God does. It's a gospel based on family, on a good job, on having enough, on being wealthy. It's all the good things that trip us up. It also devalues the genuine gospel. We slowly get to a point where we recognize what the gospel can do, but we don't put the value in it because it hasn't been doing it for us. But actually, we don't have the real gospel. We're not living in it. I'm not talking about you have not left Egypt. I'm not talking about you not being saved. I'm talking about this journey you're taking. Something is not right. And thirdly, it's unreliable. You see, the fake gospels don't deal with our heart. They can't deal with our heart. In fact, they do the exact opposite. They distract us for when God does want to deal with our heart. The gospel deals with the inside of the person first. The fake gospel comes to deal with the outside first. It presents a good picture. The fake gospels do not deal with our fears and insecurities. It does the exact opposite. It makes it worse. See, as the Israelites are walking into the wilderness, their fears catch up with them. Egypt never does, but their fears and their insecurities do. It cannot make sense of failure or difficulty. And lastly, but not at all the least important, it's boring. Fake gospels are boring. And I think some people feel a pressure to make the kingdom of God look exciting. It's exciting all by itself. You don't need to help it. You just need to get to know the real king. You need to learn to walk with him. And I'm careful because what I'm saying kind of might sound like you're not saved. I'm not saying that. I'm saying as a person that knows what it is to leave Egypt, we can camp on the edge of the Red Sea. We can refuse to walk. So what do these three stories tell us? The first one. After 3 days' walk, God instructs them. The presence of God goes with them. The pillar of fire by night and the cloud by day. And they follow that presence. And for 3 days, it's dry. There's nothing. There's no water. And after 3 days, they get to water, but it is bitter. The water is bitter. See, water speaks of life in the Bible. Where there's water, there's life. It's been raining here in Pretoria a lot this last week, and if you look, the grass is all green, and it's looking good. If you go to Cape Town, it's not looking good because it's dry. There's no water. There's no life. And so sometimes we walk a journey with God, and it feels dry, and then we get to a place where there's water, but we can't drink. There's no life. It's because there's bitterness. And we see this bitterness, and we blame Moses, the people that are leading us. We blame God who has led us here. We blame everything. But we don't see that the bitterness is preventing life in us. And what God tells Moses to do is he says, take a stick and throw it into the water. Take the cross. Take the cross and apply it to your bitterness. See, bitterness is where we feel like we've been unfairly treated. We feel like actually this is what I did, and then this is what happened, and those two don't match. And it creeps up on all of us. I'm facing a work situation at the moment, which will most likely involve disciplinary procedure. And there's what I did, and then there's the extent of what's being said. And I don't feel like the two match. Maybe they do, I'm not sure. But I feel like they don't match. Now, at that point, bitterness grabs a hold of you really nicely. And the people that said that thing, I just want to prove them wrong. Yes, I would love to. And the guys that started that thing and that, and there's a whole bunch of mitigation things, but we don't realize that the bitterness growing in us, we need Jesus to deal with that thing. The second one, they're hungry. Which is interesting. When the Israelites left Egypt, they looted Egypt. They literally took as much as they could carry with them. And now they're in the wilderness and they've run out. They've got no more food. They've run out of resources. And the answer that God has is manna from heaven. You see, it teaches us two things. The Israelites had been used to, this was their paradigm. You work, you plant, you harvest, and then you stockpile what you have. The more you stockpile, the more independent you are. That's how Egypt worked. And when they left Egypt, they left with their stockpile. But their stockpile runs out. So God teaches them two things. Number one, he will provide for you, not your stockpile. We must learn to be dependent on him. And the stockpile runs out, not because we didn't have a big stockpile, but because the things that God are calling us to require way more resources than we have. And I'm not talking about just financial resources. Your emotional resources, your spiritual resources, your capacity as a person. You will come to the end of those when you are journeying to what God has for you. Those will end. And we cannot stockpile. We cannot rely on the stockpile. We must rely on what God can provide. And he will provide it every day what we need. He will not provide us with a new stockpile. The second thing we learned is they had learned that you plant. You plant and you work hard and then you harvest. And now every day they're told to go out and just collect what God has for them. See, it is not the work that brings the manna. It's God's goodness. And he supplies it every day. We need to learn to trust his goodness every day. And the third story is the rock and the water. You see, the people have learned something about God now. And they should know better. And they get to a point where there's no water again. And now they want to kill Moses. And God tells Moses to get the stick, get the staff which you struck the Nile with. See, that staff had become a picture of God's judgment over Egypt. And so when God says, Moses, go out in front of the people with that stick, as an Israelite, you are standing there looking, and out comes Moses, and he's holding that stick. That stick that turned the Nile to blood. That stick that destroyed the armies of Egypt. That stick that destroyed Egypt. He's holding that. And you have been quarreling with him. You are arguing with him. You are taking him on, and now you want to kill him, and he's holding the judgment. And God says to Moses, I mean, imagine as an Israelite, you stand there, you're like, oh, now comes something, or oh, it's going to be bad. It's bad for me right now. And God tells Moses, walk straight past the people. They deserve the judgment, but walk past the people, stand on the rock, and strike the rock. That rock is Jesus. See, we forget, we think that the judgment of God on Egypt now falls on us if we get it wrong. If we fail, out comes that same stick. That same stick which God uses to deal with our past, now he's going to deal with us. He's going to sort us out. But he doesn't. He strikes Jesus. And out of Jesus comes water. Out of Jesus comes life. And when we have these pictures of who our God is, And one by one, God takes the Israelites to a place where they need something. And he shows them who he is again. Time after time, he does this. He teaches them that he can deal with their bitterness. He can deal with it. He can deal with providing for them. He can deal with their failures. They failed badly. He can deal with that. One after the next. So what is the point of this? That God basically just strips us and then teaches us a lesson and then sends us off. And that's life. Welcome. You know, is that the point? No, the point is that God has a plan for this nation. He has a promise for them. And he's teaching them and he's building them up for that plan, for that promise. In Joshua 8, they've now gone through the wilderness. God has taken this nation that considered themselves Egyptians, and he's taught them again and again who he is, how he can provide, how it's not your own effort that provides the manna every day, how he can provide every day, how he can deal with your past, how he can deal with bitterness. And they start to move into the promised land, and they cross the first river, the Jordan River. And as they get to the other side, he asked them to circumcise every male. And the place where they camp, they call that place Gilgal. And God says in Joshua, I have rolled away the reproach of Egypt on you here. It's 40 years later. 40 years later, God says, I have rolled Egypt away where they were circumcised. You see, he's doing two things again. Number one, he's now putting an outward sign where they wanted their own outward sign. He has worked something on the inside. He's taken off all their jewelry that came from Egypt. And now he's marked them as his people. He puts an outward sign that they are identifiably God's people. Both the outside and what is left of the ways and the values of Egypt. And they've learned to follow a real God. And he's rolled Egypt away. Now, this is a picture of what we live in. The Israelites going through the wilderness. There was a Kai actually saying these words at our pre-service at the prayer meeting. No eye has seen, no ears heard, and what no mind has conceived, these things God has prepared for those who love him. We are not called to a promised land. We are called to something far greater. That promised land was a picture for us, but that's not the reality. The reality is far better. That reality is Jesus. He died, he was buried, and God rolled the stone away. Just like he rolls Egypt back, he says, I've rolled the reproach of Egypt away. He does the same for us. You see, in Jesus, we have the Lamb whose blood was painted on the door that we do not face the judgment of Egypt. In Jesus, we are baptized through the Red Sea, and the power of our past, Egypt, is destroyed. In Jesus, when we get to our bitterness, we can deal with it. We don't have to sit there. He can turn our bitterness into sweetness. The very thing that makes us bitter, the very thing that we will not face, he can turn that into sweetness. When we run out of resources, when we get to the end of ourselves, the bread of heaven, Jesus, provides for us. He is the one that provides for us every day. We can learn dependency on him. And lastly, when we fail, when we get it completely wrong, that judgment does not land on us. Life lands on us. The rock is struck and life flows to us. See, I want Jesus as a real king. And how it works out is that we want to keep him at arm's length. Can I ask you, what is your price? What I mean by that is, at what point do you say, Jesus, that far and no further? That far and no further. That thing that happened, you can deal with everything else. Don't touch that. Have you ever felt like at one point God asked you or called you to do something and it failed? How far and no further? Can God ask that again? When you've run out, when you're empty, how far? At what point will we say, actually, I don't want a mediated relationship with Jesus? I don't want the list of instructions. I want the person himself. I want to live with that presence of Jesus in my life. You see, Moses lived and then he died. He led the people, but he did not lead them into an inheritance. We have a new Moses, one that can. He can lead us into our inheritance. What is that thing? That thing that Jesus cannot get to. Every time he gets there, you step back. Father God, I thank you for this picture. I thank you for the example you have left in Scripture to us. I thank you that we can live with an incredible hope because of that. You did not leave them on the edge of the Red Sea, and you took them on. You took them further than that. And we see in their example that it is not what they expected. It was far better than they expected. And we believe for our lives, Father, you are doing something. You are working a process. You are bringing about something better than we expected. Something better than we could envision with our own eyes. Better than what we've heard of, Father. And I pray that we would one day walk into a place where we can roll back Egypt. We can roll slavery off of us. That it would not be something that lives in our hearts, Father. You have brought us out of Egypt, Father. Would you take Egypt out of us?